You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. National park budgets across the country are getting hit hard by federal funding cuts, and Land Between the Lakes is no exception. LBL officials are holding a series of public meetings to get ideas on how to spend the park's limited resources. Shelley Baskin spoke with LBL Area Supervisor Bill Lasowski to find out what insight they expect to gain from the meetings.
About two-thirds of the dollars that we spend at LBL each year are from appropriations, federal appropriations that Congress gives to the agency. About a third are the revenues from our fees.
And do you have a hard number for approximately how much you're losing with this 50% cut in maintenance?
The best way to answer that question is probably to say that the total for Land Between the Lakes last year in that account was about $1.7 million. So our challenge is to try to identify ways of being able to balance about a $750,000 to $850,000 reduction. On the other hand, the road maintenance is down about 12%. And so we've got a smaller budget to work with, but we still have a significant number of things that we need to do that we've got to identify for being able to balance that account.
As far as finding new sources of revenue, I understand that a lot of these places use fees. Would there be fee increases to kind of balance that out?
Well, the key part of our public meeting and our public process is to really let the public think about the challenge. And we're confident that as they look at ways that we can be more efficient and thus cut our costs, and then look at the potential for some of the fees perhaps to be increased as a way of maintaining some of the services, that we'll come up with those best ideas that make sense. The Forest Service really doesn't have any predetermined ideas on exactly what we need to do. So I really can't answer your question in a more complete way until after we've had the public process.
Would there be any chance of layoffs to make up the difference in the $750,000?
Well, our hope is that we can find solutions that won't require that. But when we outline a budget reduction like I have to admit that there are some potential services that we may have to discontinue. We look hard at every position that we fill, the Forest Service. In fact, we've left three positions vacant in the last 18 months as a way of trying to anticipate and mitigate some of the budget reductions. But we work quite a bit with partner organizations, with volunteers, with other contractors. And certainly as we adjust services, they could potentially be affected. But our goal right now as we go into this process is to try to find solutions that mitigate that the best way we can, and hopefully still maintain quality and safe recreation and environmental education at Land Between the Lakes.
With these public meetings, what do you hope that you're able to take away from them other than just more ideas? Is there specific things that you would like to see people bring to the table at these meetings?
Well, I certainly want there to be a creative spirit about their public lands. Some folks take for granted that Land Between the Lakes is 170,000 acres managed by the Forest Service, but they actually own the land. We just manage it for them. And so what I'm counting on is that they'll articulate to us what their values of the public lands are at Land Between the Lakes. What are the things that we do that they think are the most important? If I can take away a sense of that priority, of the most important, and maybe some of the things that are a little less important, or maybe even some things that we continue to do, perhaps that the public has decided aren't important anymore, then I have the best chance of being able to make a good decision as we go forward.
You mentioned coming to the end of this and having projections for a high, medium, or low budget. How will the decision on how to implement these ideas ultimately be made?
It'll be a Forest Service decision. We will go through an extensive public involvement process to really ferret out all the information that we can from the community, from our visitors, from our partners, from the folks that use LBL. And then we'll end that process, and then the Forest Service will actually work internally to try to identify the best decisions to move forward.
Once you've solicited these ideas, how long do you think it'll take before people start to see the implementation of the ideas?
I think that's a really difficult question for me to even try to answer, not knowing what the ideas are. I would characterize them as if they are logical no-brainers. They may be very easy to implement. If they're ones that are much more far-reaching, and perhaps there are some services that might impact some of the traditional users or some folks that may have reservations already in place, those kinds of changes might take a little while to implement. And certainly we may decide to do something short term and set our sights on some longer term things that may take a while to implement, plan out, and then actually do the work to have that come online. So it's really going to probably depend on which ideas make the most sense and which decisions we can move ahead on in the short term versus the long term.
Bill Lasowski is the Forest Services Area Supervisor for Land Between the Lakes. The third of the four public meetings on the budget cuts is April 26th at the Stewart County Visitor Center in Dover, Tennessee.
The Human Rights Commission in Paducah paid tribute to fair housing practices in the area by honoring Habitat for Humanity and the Merriman House Domestic Crisis Center Thursday. Casey Northcutt provides a quick update on the efforts in Paducah to build homes for low-income families.
Homes have sprung up around the area as part of a citywide effort to provide housing to all segments of the population. Bernice Belt is the interim chair for the Paducah Human Rights Commission. She says the city recently has made many strides to ensure that all residents have equal access to housing.
We have more housing. We have existing housing that have been refurbished, and now they blend in and instead of looking like low-rent housing, they look like really nice apartments that anybody would want to live in.
The Human Rights Commission honored Habitat for Humanity for constructing its first-ever solar handicapped accessible home. The Merriman House received its award for an apartment project it recently completed to house center clients. Merriman House Assistant Director Don York says she was impressed that many nonprofit business and government leaders showed up to talk about such an important issue.
It's remarkable for me to come to an event like this and be able to see people from different systems within our city and talk about something so impactful like fair housing. You have the police department and nonprofits, legislators, policymakers from the whole city coming together and showing what fair housing means to them and how important it is for our citizens of Paducah.
The city has several housing projects of its own. Before the Human Rights Commission bestowed the day's honors, Mayor Bill Paxton spoke briefly about the Fountain Avenue Neighborhood Revitalization Project, one of Paducah's chief housing endeavors. In 2007, the city commission adopted a plan to refurbish this area, and the city eventually acquired 87 properties as a part of a program to assist low to moderate income families. So far, the entire investment in Fountain Avenue total $6 million. Bernice Belt says these efforts are vital to the well-being of those in need.
It raises the self-worth of people to know that even though they may not own the property, the people who own it and the people who run it, they care enough about the way it looks and about the way it makes people feel that they work hard at pursuing grants, at partnering with other organizations and working together to make all those improvements.
Director of the Paducah Planning Department, Steve Irvin, says once the city has completed the Fountain Avenue project, the city commission will meet again. It will discuss whether or not it should revitalize another section of Paducah and what section it should choose. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
Early last month, Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear's Blue Ribbon Commission on Tax Reform held its first meeting to begin the process of addressing a long-discussed issue in the Commonwealth. They'll wrap up their workshops early next month and begin a series of public meetings around the state with a session in Paducah in late May. Tax reform is a complex and contentious set of issues, and to get some perspective on how the commission will navigate those issues, I sat down with one of its members, CSI Chairman and former board chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, John Williams Sr.
The commission will have held a total of 12 meetings by the end of the year, and they're meeting all over the Commonwealth. You've already met twice, in both times in Frankfurt, and you'll meet again in Frankfurt and in Paducah next month. What's the purpose behind these meetings, and why are they being held throughout the state?
Well, across the state, purpose is for public hearings. We have five public hearings, the first one being May 29th in Paducah, and there's one in each congressional district through August. The meetings in Frankfurt have been our workshop meetings, and we will have one more May the 8th. And the first two workshop sessions, actually we've met three times, but two of them have been working sessions. We're developing a foundation of understanding the tax system and what the options might be. But when we go on the road across the state, the purpose of that is to listen to the public.
Well, some have been talking about the need for modernizing the tax code. Do you know what that means when they say that?
Typically, someone who says that is reflecting the change in the economy to be a more service-based economy. And that speaks to sales tax on some services, primarily personally consumable services. And we do have more activity in that side than we had 30 years ago, for example. That would be modernizing. Another example of modernizing would be if you look at the Kentucky personal income tax return, you'll see that we have a progressive system, but it's progressive only from $2,000 a year to $8,000 a year. And that was set in 1930. And so there's no logic to it today. And if you compute the differences between 2, 3, 4, 5, 5.8, and then 6%, which are the numbers on the personal tax return, you compute those at $75,000, the difference between 6% across the board and those staggered is only $344. So it's more perception than reality.
Right. Well, according to Governor Beshear, the commission has five goals, the first being fairness. With President Obama's current rhetoric about the Buffett rule, that's an issue that's received quite a bit of attention lately. As it stands now, how fair is Kentucky's tax code to the individual taxpayer?
Well, you have to start by understanding that the level of progressivity at personal tax level is totally different states from federal. Mm-hmm. I mean, federal is a totally different situation than states. And there aren't any states that deal with the same kind of progressivity questions that we deal with at the federal level. The fairness issues that we've looked at so far deal, when you look across industries, on the commercial side, for example, on the corporate side, over time, the General Assembly has adopted exemptions for specific industries. So just because you're in business doesn't mean that you're paying a fair rate compared to other people in business. That's one classic example of fairness that we have looked at, and literally there are some striking exceptions in that regard.
Are there any proposals on the table now that could make it fair? Do you think, for instance, that restoring Kentucky's estate tax that would apply to people with assets over $1 million or closing exemptions on luxury services like limo rides would make the code more fair?
Well, a limousine is an example of a service that's not taxed today. I recently looked at the 183 services that are classified by the Tax Administrators Association. And limousine is in that, or country club fees are in that, okay, that are not currently taxed as a sales tax in Kentucky. And yes, you could suggest that. But likewise, that would include taxidermy and hairdressers and barbershops for consideration, although barbershops and hairdressers, there's only seven states in the nation that tax those. But landscaping services and country club fees and limousine rides are examples that today are exempt from taxation. Today, Kentucky does not have an estate tax. Mm. However, Kentucky is tied to the federal. And we will have a reinstatement of our estate tax as of January 1, 2013, unless Congress takes some form of action. Mm-hmm. But there was a decision made many years ago that Kentucky needed to eliminate inheritance taxes and estate taxes to reduce folks who were frankly migrating to income tax-free states as they retired. And we have experienced a lot of that over the years and still do. Tennessee is a tax-free state except on dividends and interest. Florida is a totally income tax-free state. And so you get folks who reach retirement age who also are going to be facing inheritance or estate tax issues for their families, who frankly will change their residency in order to dodge those. So Kentucky may come back with an estate tax, but frankly, I would expect the opposite to occur. Now, you asked the question in the context of progressivity, okay, and the Buffett rule kind of thing,
right,
where you seem to be coming from. But frankly, I would think if any action comes out of our committee, although we've taken no votes and there's been no consensus forming, so this is purely one person's perspective, if anything were to come, my prediction would be that it would be to decouple us from the federal so that estate tax would not return to being applying in Kentucky.
So you see the reinstatement of an estate tax as a potential detriment.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of the commission's other goals is competitiveness to attract business and investment. Is it possible to balance that factor with fairness to achieve another commission goal, which is adequacy, ensuring there's enough revenue to sustain state services? And how simple, that's another goal, how simple could that end result really be?
Well, I can tell you that in the work in the last two sessions of the task force, almost every topic that's been on the table has had a yardstick. How does it relate, red, green, or yellow, literally in a coding form, okay, on fairness, simplicity, competitiveness, adequacy. But that has been initiated by the state economist who's done the academic kind of a view and presented his thinking to the commission. And frankly, Tuesday, one or two of his conclusions were challenged by commission members who saw the issue right opposite his view. All I could say at this point is that each of those yardsticks are being discussed at considerable depth. The competitiveness deals with comparison primarily to other states. Probably the most dramatic, well, the two most dramatic comparisons to Kentucky are Indiana and Tennessee. Tennessee with no personal income tax except on dividends and interest, and much more favorable corporate tax structure, but they have a higher sales tax, and sales tax covers groceries. Looking at Indiana, just on the surface, you might look at the personal income tax in Indiana, it's 3.4%. Well, dig deeper. They don't allow itemized deductions. Well, what they've done is they've dramatically simplified the tax process for personal income. And the economist on Tuesday looked at me and made an observation and said, you know, simplicity, the ideal would be a postcard, you know, that you file your tax on a postcard. But frankly, both Tennessee and Indiana create some competitiveness issues for Kentucky.
John Williams Sr. is a member of Governor Steve Beshear's Blue Ribbon Commission on Tax Reform. The commission is set to begin a series of public meetings around Kentucky on May 29th in Paducah.
I got my income tax this morning. Yeah, and it got to be paid. I got my income tax slip this morning. Yeah, and it's got to be paid. It's a shame, it's a shame. Notice tag my boss's name.
Ahead on Front Page Sunday, the weekly offer at Maiden Alley Cinema, plus a conversation on cyber insecurity. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe.
In a world of ever-growing technology, global interconnectivity, privacy, and security are increasingly rare commodities. Richard Thieme is an author and lecturer who addresses the challenges posed by these new technologies, including the personal and even spiritual transformations people undergo as they adapt to a new world. He spoke this week at a technology summit at Murray State University, and Gary Pitts sat down with him to talk about the dangers of interacting with technology and how to meet those challenges.
You have degrees in English and English literature and also in theology. You were an Episcopal priest for 16 years. How did you get to be an internet security expert?
Good question. Long answer that I'll make as short as humanly possible. In the 1980s, I bought my kid an Apple II Plus. We started playing with it. Because of the background in literature, which I taught at the University of Illinois, I kind of knew how text worked. And I became aware that by interacting with the computer and playing interactive fiction games, I was being changed by the process. And I realized that if this was going to happen to everybody in society and the computers were all connected to each other and people were connected to the computer in a symbiotic relationship, then the transformation I intuitively, and it turns out correctly, discerned was going to happen to society as well.
So you're dealing, I guess, with the personal side.
That's right.
Of technology. And part of what you talk about is internet insecurity and people's personal information and their personal expressions. What are some common mistakes that people make to cause them to lose their privacy and security?
Well, first of all, the most obvious is that people are concerned about privacy and yet give everything away on Facebook, Google, Twitter, you name it. And so people are showing everything, are giving away everything. I even wrote a short story. I started writing fiction about this about a dozen years ago, about the Roswell crash being a suicide crash by aliens who wanted us to find the technology, build the internet, and they could save a lot of time by just us putting on the internet everything about us, and then they would know everything about us. So the first thing is that people are often unconscious of the fact that it's not a private space. Like Facebook, we are not the customers. We are the product. The customers are people who pay for the data about us. People who go on Facebook and share everything, these are my favorite books and movies, and this is where I'm going, and this is where I want to live, and all that. You can cut and dice and slice that data and all kinds of packages and sell it. So the number one thing is that people themselves find the joy of using the medium so exhilarating that they become totally unconscious of what, in fact, they're doing to set themselves up for both good and fraudulent encounters with others. Second thing is that by giving away so much information, you can encourage people to do what we call spear phishing, which is so identify who you are or who you talk to that they can target you in a very particular way. Someone might receive an email that is so precise that it sounds exactly like who it says it's coming from. And it says, like, we've been out of the meeting an hour and I realized I forgot to give you this document. Click on it. And when it comes from a trusted colleague down the hall or in another building who you just saw an hour ago, it sounds so legitimate that you click on it. And that's how RSA was compromised throughout its enterprise. It's also well known that our systems have been penetrated by foreign elements, especially the Chinese. They're in the news a lot lately, but others do it too. In that world, there are no allies. There's only targets. And we're as much of a target because we have more data to take than anybody else. And so we're penetrated. And that means that people unknowingly are sometimes going to websites that they don't know, that they aren't trusted, or they get an error message. They don't know what to do with it. It says, this is something that may not be good. Do you want to go there anyway? Well, you don't have the information from that silly, really stupid announcement to make a decision in an informed way. And of course you want to go there. That's why you clicked on the website. And you click, and there's a download immediately and invisibly, and you're part of a bot network that are used to do multiple mailings for spammers or all kinds of other things. Or a Trojan is dropped into your system, and the Trojan can read your keystrokes and report out whatever you're doing. And yet, it's a dangerous world. People say, oh, I don't go on the computer. And I say, do you get gas at a station and use a credit card? There could be a skimmer on the gas pump. Do you do banking? Do you, above all, use a smartphone for any of these transactions? Because smartphones and the myriads of applications for iPads and iPhones and so forth, they're not safe. They're not vetted for security. And once you have a weak link in the chain, you can be inside the fence. There is no secure perimeter, so you shouldn't use your phone for any secure transaction or important transaction. You should not do banking over your iPhone or your Android. You just should think about the real vulnerabilities that are permeating the system that we've built because it was never built for security. Security is an add-on to a system that was built for ease of access and familiarity with trusted partners. So think what you're doing before you click is the lesson, if there is one.
There's a great deal of effort that goes into security software and trying to prevent downloading some sort of virus or someone being able to get into your information. But what you're saying is hackers' jobs or people who are trying to take your information is being made easier as social networking is growing?
It's made easier by every advance in the technology because hackers in the old days had to know what they were doing. They wrote their own code. They did their own programming. They knew how the system worked. So you had to be smarter, and there were fewer of you. Now all you need to do is know how to go to a website and download the tools for hacking. It's point and click.
You mentioned earlier people going by like a scanner at a gas pump or in a store or something like that. And I've heard about people are able to like scan your credit card or something through your wallet, through your jeans. What kind of technology is going into that sort of thing?
The likelihood of someone standing next to you at the 7-Eleven having the means, the motivation, and the knowledge of what to do with it when they stand next to you and pick something off your smart card, it's probably not going to happen. Demonstrating proof of concept that something can happen is one thing. Looking at the likelihood it's going to happen is something else. Gas pumps, though, they're easy to connect wirelessly to skimmers, which are going to skim your credit card number. But if you think about it, how many times you go into a restaurant and give a credit card to a waiter who disappears for 5 minutes and comes back? And all they have to do, and we have crimes on record, of course, is swipe it through their machine. And then they're paid in bulk for credit card numbers by criminals. So there are lots of ways you can use your credit card, but you still use it. And you use it because it's guaranteed that you're not going to lose any money if you've been defrauded. It's passed on to you anyway. The credit card companies are not going to absorb that. They'll just add it to the cost of doing business. So part of it is to come to terms with the profound transformation in availability of information that used to be private because there is no privacy anymore, and changing the way you act in the world to be congruent with what you are willing to put out there and what you don't want people to have.
You've been in these hacker circles and in the security circles. From your perspective, what is it that drives someone to be on one side of the fence rather than the other?
Well, there are no sides to the fence. It's like a Mobius strip. You may start off thinking you're walking north, but you wind up walking south and you're back in your own lap. By that, I mean hacking is not defined as a behavior. The same behavior, depending on your perceived allegiance and who people think you're doing it for, will designate you as a terrorist or a hacker or a patriot working for the NSA that has only targets everywhere in the world. That's hacking. And I used to say in early talks, if you want to hack, come into the intelligence community where you get the best tools and techniques in the business and you can hack your hearts out and be exempt from prosecution. Hacking is indistinguishable as to its behavior from patriotic work on behalf of the intelligence community. A profound religious person, an investigative reporter, also might be engaged in hacking, all for different purposes.
So it becomes more of a philosophical debate than...
Yeah, who are you aligned with? Who do you work for?
And there are those who specialize in security rather than hacking. So who's winning this battle?
A hacker, a criminal only has to get in once. A defender has to stop everything. So the criminals are always ahead, no matter how we ramp up our defenses. So are we winning the battle against cyber? No. No, we've created a platform that's full of holes, and we don't know how to fully defend it. But can we live with the risk, or do you have to become streetwise and figure out how to avoid greater risk than you want to take in order to live your life?
Richard Thieme, you've given me quite a bit to think about, and I appreciate you coming in and talking with me today.
Pleasure, a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to know more about Thieme's lectures or publications, you can find a link at our website, wkms.org. Loading complete. Playing at Paducah's Maiden Alley Cinema this week is the Iranian film that won this year's Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, A Separation. The drama focuses on a middle-class married couple who reluctantly separate and the conflicts that arise when the husband hires a lower-class caretaker for his elderly father, who's suffering from Alzheimer's disease. The film is in Persian with subtitles, but don't let that deter you. Maiden Alley's Larry Thomas and I talk about how the plot and the performances overcome the language barrier.
When I went to Maiden Alley to watch Between Two Rivers, which was an excellent documentary, I got to see the trailer for A Separation. And the trailer portrays it as equal parts kind of almost an Iranian Kramer versus Kramer, but there's also this kind of suspense thriller part of it.
Yeah, and that comes from the fact that in Iranian society, I mean, every aspect of life is ruled by religion, which also extends to every aspect of law. You can't have one without the other, and it allows zilch for considering the people involved. And that's what the emotional feeling is in this film, because you have this couple who are, okay, they're fine, they're making it, but they want to move away. But she wants to go now, and he doesn't because his father has dementia. So she moves to her mother's house. But in order to do that, the law and the religion say she has to file for divorce, but they don't want to be divorced. So this just puts another wrinkle in things. It's a good look at the Iranian people and how they have to live under Islamic law.
So there's a humanizing quality to it.
Extremely humanizing. People only think of Iran in terms of sound bites on TV news and, you know, nuclear arms and crazy politicians and all that. Iran is also made up of people just like you and me. They live differently. They have different things on their plate, but, you know, they're still people.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting because the heroine, if that term can be used, the actress's name is Leila Hatami. Very striking looking woman, very, very pale complected with bright red hair.
Right.
Is there any symbolism to that? Because she doesn't look like anyone else in the film.
Well, there's probably some symbolism to that. Even in those countries over there, not everybody looks like everybody else.
This film is in Persian?
With subtitles.
I see. But again,
don't let that put you off.
Right.
These days, people should have absolutely no qualms about subtitles, considering the amount of information that passes across the bottom of your TV screen every night.
Well, I have to say that from the trailer alone, I almost didn't have to see subtitles to understand exactly what was going on. These actors are conveying so much emotion. The subtitles are almost in the way.
Yeah. I mean, these people are such great actors. They are terrific at portraying what it is they want us to see and feel. Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
So this is one of those films that works on a lot of levels. If you want to go see a really good film, this is a good one. If you want to go see something that portrays a much more nuanced picture of the Iranian people, this is still a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a film that managed to do an end run around the old saying that you can never tell what's going to win the Oscar for Best Foreign Film because the best film usually doesn't. Mm. This time it did. All I can say is it's one terrific movie.
You can find showtimes at WKMS.org.
Coming up, a conversation with singer-songwriter Joe Pug. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Recently, the Iser Art Center opened a competitive exhibition featuring Not a Drop of Paint. The artist's work deals in the tactile, pliable, and stitchable. Fantastic Fibers welcomes the work of non-traditional artists from around the globe. In preparation for the exhibition, WKMS's Drew Adams spoke to Laura Rock, a former winner of Fantastic Fibers and a contributing artist this year. When Laura isn't in her Nebraska studio, she spends her time creating quilts, teaching workshops, and lecturing across the country. She creates vibrant and complex quilts with a time-intensive technique she best describes as painting with thread. The artist takes some time out of her schedule to speak of her medium, method, and a unique source of inspiration.
So how many years have you submitted work for Fantastic Fibers?
This is my third year.
And you won your first year?
I did. That was so exciting.
With Catherine, Kathy, Katie, and Kate, correct?
Uh-huh.
So can you tell me a little bit about your specific style and your medium?
Specific style is portraiture. I use a lot of thread. The piece Catherine, Kathy, Katie, and Kate, her face was done entirely with layers and layers of thread. So I paint with the thread basically to create the facial features of the subject.
So since you're using needle and thread instead of paint, I'm assuming the process is much more time-consuming. I would imagine that you choose your subject carefully?
I'm usually inspired by a photograph. I have a whole hat box full of photographs that have been given to me that I've gotten at auction that cover a span of probably 100 or 120 years. And I will go through that box and look at it, see who pops out that kind of says, I'm next.
You're getting these pictures from random places. I imagine some of them are people you know, but many of these are people you've never actually known?
Exactly. Catherine was a really, really good friend of mine, and she passed away from ovarian cancer. At her memorial, we all talked about all the different aspects of Kate that we knew. At the end, we toasted to Catherine, Kathy, Katie, and Kate. So at that point, I knew I wanted to do something that helped me remember the intense person that she was. So I did her. A lot of the pieces are just strangers to me. So I go through and see who pops out and says that they want to be my next subject.
So you could look through the box and see a picture that you've seen maybe 40, 50 times before and never really wanted to paint that time because of your mood or where you're at in your life. You might want to paint that?
Yes. Often I tell people that they get my attention. And sometimes I look specifically for something as well. Sometimes I say, all right, let's look for women with hats. And just as you said, I might have had tons of pictures in there with women with hats, but never really had a reason to look for them before. And then they pop up and they kind of call to me or they say, no, not this time. It's very strange.
But interesting. I imagine you see different aspects of yourself. Or you can flesh out your moods depending on what you pay.
I do. Or it just happens to be their turn to have their story told.
Why portraiture then, when stories could be so much easier to glean from an action shot or a picture of someone doing something in their native habitat?
I am intrigued. I am intrigued by the story someone's face can tell you. You know, it runs the gamut from pure joy to sorrow to an intense look, like with Catherine. I have had people tell me that she seems to watch them cross in front of her as they're looking at the portrait. I like trying to create an emotion that people can relate to or even wonder about. I see something usually in the photograph that makes me wonder who that person is, like the Big Daddy that is in the Yicer exhibition. He just made me laugh. He's this enormous man with a suit on and overalls on top of that and another jacket on top of that, sitting on this precariously small stool with a boy on his lap. And it just made me giggle because, you know, what's the story here? Why has he got this little boy and yet his face is so intense and the little boy's face is so dead on at the camera? So it was fun to try and translate that into fabric and thread.
Lastly, I'm interested in the difficulties in your medium. You're not necessarily painting, so do you find that you're limited? I'm wondering if the palette was different because the materials were different in and of themselves.
I guess the palette could be considered limited to a lot of people when they look in. They go, well, you know, you have to pick just the right fabric to do what you want it to do. But I find that's part of the game that's fun, seeing if I can find a fabric that just this quarter inch of it does exactly what I want it to do, whether it creates the illusion of a brow or the side of a chin or a shadow. And then using the fabric in an unexpected way is also really exciting.
And so you paint with your thread, and you take all those quarter-inch pieces to put together something of real consequence. Do you feel that what you're doing is just as moving and important as the more regularly accepted high art forms of painting and sculpture?
I believe that what I do is important, not just to me, because I love it, but I also see people when they come into my studio and they stand and they stare at a piece and want to know the story. That's the exciting part, that somehow what I have done with my fabric and with my thread, somehow that has touched them in a way that they want to know more, whether it's knowing more about the people in the portrait or knowing more about what I do or how I do it or where I get my ideas. I love the idea that they want to know more, and I tell them. I pretty much tell them anything they want to know.
Drew Adams spoke with artist Laura Rock. Fantastic Fibers is on offer at the Iser Art Center in Paducah through May 5th. It's only been 4 years since singer-songwriter Joe Pug quit his day job to focus on music full-time. The Maryland native and Austin resident has already garnered comparisons to musicians like R.E.M., Iron and Wine, John Prine, and Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I've come to know the wish list of my father. I've come to know the shipwrecks where he wished. I've come to wish aloud among the overdressed crowd. Come to witness now the sinking of the ship.
The former carpenter and recent South by Southwest artist is the next performer at Murray State's Love It Live series. Beyond the Edge host Tracy Ross and Love It Live host Matt Parker sit down to speak with Pug about his creative process, the inevitable comparisons to Bob Dylan, and his latest album, The Great Despiser.
Joe, the first question that I would like to ask you is one that I know you've been asked before, but I'd like to ask it for our particular audience. It's kind of the elephant in the room, I guess, not only with you, but with almost every talented singer-songwriter. It's the inevitable comparisons to Bob Dylan. And so I guess my question is, do you understand why you are compared to Bob Dylan? And I guess the second part is this a burden or a boon to you?
I think that's a very fair question. I can certainly understand why I'm compared to Bob Dylan. I think Steve Earle put it best. Bob Dylan invented the job that we have, as we know it today in popular culture. In America, I don't think he necessarily invented the form. I think that this particular music has been around for hundreds of years in its own way. He was one in a very long line of practitioners.
A lot of musicians today have kind of gone away from, I guess, the standard model, which is signed to a record label, release your physical musical product, and just immediately try to get as much money as you can. It seems like even more than a lot of musicians in your generation, you've gone the other way. Early in your career especially, you were just literally giving away your music, but it seems like that actually helped you. How do you feel about that model now? Is the old sign with a record label, see where the chips fall, is that model antiquated now with today's technology?
It depends, man. For example, we are with a record label out of Nashville. It's just its role has changed dramatically. I mean, we're able to get directly to our fans, you know, and there's no one telling me what song doesn't make the album, or we get to decide ourselves. I think where there's less money, you know, you get a bigger piece of the pie. So it all works out.
Joe, you'd mentioned being with the label now, which brings me to my next question. Can you just tell us a little bit about The Great Despiser, and are there any surprises or tricks that we should expect for those that are used to The Messenger and the first EP?
Sure. Yeah, it's certainly more band-oriented. We worked with the producer for the first time, this guy named Brian Deck out of Chicago, who's done Iron and Wine stuff and Josh Ritter and Modest Mouse and a couple other bands. And he really, man, I wrote the songs in the same way, you know, where it was just me sitting down in a room alone hammering out the lyrics. But then when it came to kind of color the songs and kind of tell the emotional narrative with the musicality of it, it was a lot different this time, and I think it's much fuller. I think it's the best album I've made yet.
When you start to write a song, do you know where it's going?
Oh, man. No, I have no idea. When I wake up in the morning, I have no idea what I'm going to be doing in 5 minutes. In general, just as sort of a general life principle. So, yeah, when it comes to writing songs, I find for me, I usually do have an idea when I begin it of where I think it's going to go. I kind of pride myself on being able to let go of those expectations in the middle of the writing process. I forget what writer it was that said, you gotta kill your darlings. Even if something was your favorite line when you started the song, if you keep on moving along and the song is moving in another direction and that line doesn't fit anymore, then you have to take it out. I think that you can move in a much more interesting way when you're kind of being led by that unconscious, intuitive motion rather than a conscious, well, this is nice, and I think people think this line is really clever, you know, like, that's what I hate most in songwriting is when people try to be clever.
Question about the titling of Hymn 101, Hymn 35, and then on the new record, Hymn 76. Where does the practice of that type of titling come from?
Well, the only thing that I would really know to tell you on that is that those three songs are about the same thing. And I don't know quite what that thing is. I just know that they're all there in the same place. I think I wrote Hymn 35 first, and I just kind of named it that. And then ever since, these two other songs that fall into the same category for me, they've existed in the same universe. So I just named them that, you know.
In your press kit, I think the way it was phrased was, you realized one day while you attended school at North Carolina, you were profoundly unhappy. Was this unhappiness based on location or just where you were in life? Did you feel like there was something you would rather be doing or should be doing other than the course of study you had?
I think that any time you find someone make a sudden life change, you can go back and you can realize that it was anything but sudden and that it was years in the offing. I had spent 3 years attending the university, studying there, and I was a poor student, man. Like, I read a lot in college. I read more than any other time in my life, but I don't think I read one book that pertained to a class that I was taking. I would just go to the library, and I'd start reading one book, and then that book would lead me to another, and then that one to another, and then two more. And I've always been, like, a very intuitive person. I felt like being in a formal educational setting just didn't work for me. I got to go. If I'm thinking about something, I just got to go there right now, and I got to find out all about that thing. And that's not how formal education works, as it shouldn't. You know, you can't. I wouldn't want my doctor to be learning like this, you know, for a songwriter or an artist, it kind of works.
So what can the audience expect of you as a live performer? If they've never seen you before, I think, are you solo acoustic here at Murray?
I'm going to be solo acoustic there, and they can expect to hear songs off my first two albums. I'm also going to be playing a bunch off the new album, and I'm very excited, man. I've had a little bit of time off the road, and what's funny is when you're on the road, you actually do a lot more driving than you do playing music. So I've, with some time off, I've actually had some time to woodshed on my guitar and my voice, and this is basically the kickoff of our spring tour, so I'm just chomping at the bit, man. I can't wait.
Singer-songwriter Joe Pug performs tonight at 7:30 in Lovett Auditorium as part of Murray State's Lovett Live on Stage concert series. Tickets are $14 and are available at the CFSB Center box office, Ticketmaster.com, and The Door.
And I've come to meet the sheriff and his posse, to offer him the broadside of my jaw. I've come here to get broke, then maybe bum a smoke. We'll go drinking two towns over after all. I'll go drinking two towns over after all. And I've come to meet the legendary takers. I've only come to ask them for a lot. Oh, they say I come with less than I should rightfully possess. I say the more I buy, the more I'm bought. And the more I'm bought, the less I cost. And I've come to take their servants and their surplus.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.
And I've come to know the manger that you sleep in. I've come to be the stranger that you keep. I've come from down the road and my footsteps never slowed. Before we met, I knew we'd meet. before we met, I knew we'd meet. And I've come here to ignore your cries and heartaches. I've come to closely listen to you sing. I've come here to